Feels good this morning. Good morning, everyone. I got a bit of a nasty cough. Let's hope this goes okay. You might get a few poofs in the mic there. We'll see. I don't know. Have you ever tried one of those read the entire Bible in a year plans? Has anyone ever tried that or not? Yes, a few of you. I'll tell you, should you ever try to read the Bible straight through, the book of Leviticus is where those plans go to die. After working through Genesis and Exodus, Leviticus can feel like miserable. And the reason the book is so difficult is because the book is full of laws, ancient laws, laws that are incredibly foreign to us. They're boring, they're confusing, and at times they're just downright bizarre. And to be honest, nobody wants to read a book of laws. I mean, let me ask you this. How many of you read the entirety of Kitchener's city bylaws? I'm assuming very few of us. No. Oh, I had Melissa Bowman send me a link to them. There are literally thousands of Kitchener city bylaws, and they're boring. And they start off this way. They start off by they have to define their terms. So there's like pages on defining what a fence is. You know, we just got to be clear. Is a fence really just a structure to divide neighbors? Or is it the words we speak? What is a fence? It's like all this very philosophical ideas about what a fence is. Pages dedicated to that. And then literally thousands of city bylaws. And Leviticus is essentially like that. On top of just being laws, it's incredibly boring and bizarre. Puzzling laws there that will leave you scratching your head. But lest we think Leviticus is the only place you might find bizarre laws, we might want to check ourselves here. Consider some of these laws that are actually laws in Canada. And it took me a while to fact check these, but these are all actually laws. In Oak Bay, British Columbia, you can be fined $100 if your parrot talks too loud. It's good to know. Or in Petrolia, Ontario, it's illegal to whistle. To whistle. Yelling, shouting, hooting, whistling, or singing is prohibited, and I love it, at all times. Gary, you know what? You don't need to clean it up now, man. No. No, but you don't need to clean it up now. All right? We'll clean it up later, okay? All right. You can just have a seat. There you go. Gary, seriously, have a seat. Don't clean it up right now.
No problem.
All right? There we go. All right. In Oshawa, it's illegal to climb a tree. In Ontario, it's illegal. This one really, it did me in a little. So much for my plans. Every person traveling on a highway with a sleigh or sled drawn by a horse or other animal shall have at least two bells attached to the harness or to the sleigh or sled in such a manner as to give ample warning sound. So much for the sneak attack on the 401 in your sleigh. In Etobicoke, you can only have 3.5 inches of bath water. That doesn't sound like a fun bath. In Toronto, it's illegal, only on Sundays, thank goodness, to drag a dead horse down Yonge Street. And this one's my favorite. In Alberta, it's illegal to set fire to the leg of a wooden-legged man. How often were people setting fire to wooden-legged men that they're like, that's enough, we need a rule, we need a law around this, no more. But if you think Canada's bizarre, oh, it only gets crazier south of the border, right? How about some weird U.S. laws? In Baltimore, Maryland, it's illegal to bring a lion to the movies, and you just know down there somebody tried it. Sir, you can't. What? There's no law against it. Yeah. In Florida, unfortunately, no unmarried woman can skydive on Sundays. Sorry. Sorry about that. Also in Florida, if an elephant is left at a parking meter, the owner is not exempt from the fees and will be ticketed at an expired meter. This also applies to alligators and goats. Woman in Kentucky may never wear a swimsuit while driving, as they may, as long as they carry a weapon for self-defense or have two police officers accompanying them. That's a little, wow. In Massachusetts, you may take a gorilla for a drive, but it has to sit in the passenger seat. Sir, is that gorilla in the back seat? Yeah, that's going to be a problem. You know the rule. Only in the front seat. I really like this one. I don't know why. In North Dakota, all members of North Dakota's Dry Pea and Lentil Council must be citizens. I don't care if you have a passion for dry lentils, you must be a citizen, sir. This one is so specific. In Missouri, if a bull or ram over the age of 1 year runs rampant for more than 3 days, any person may castrate the animal without assuming liability for damage. Three town residents must attest in writing that the animal is loose, and its owner must fail to reclaim or confine the beast after notice is given. That's so specific. In California, a frog that dies during a frog jumping contest cannot be eaten. That makes sense. That makes sense. Finally, in Minnesota, any contest in which participants try to capture a greased or oiled pig is illegal. But you can still just capture pigs on your own time. As long as they're not greased, you're all good. These are weird laws, and Leviticus is basically something very similar to that. There are boring laws in Leviticus, and then there are very bizarre laws, at least to our sensibilities, and so it's easy to get lost, lose sight of things. But what really piques my curiosity about Leviticus is this. These laws were set up after the people had wandered in the wilderness for 40 years. And given that these Hebrew people had known slavery and poverty well, given that their lives had been characterized by hardship, I'm very curious around how their laws might speak to how a collective group of people should treat those in poverty. With enslavement and poverty fresh in their minds, might the laws that God gives them here have anything to teach us around poverty today? And I think they do. Their laws around poverty in particular are fascinating to me. And even though these laws are thousands of years old, I think they're incredibly instructive. Because here to me is the universal challenge. Insofar as I can tell, in every culture, city, or society that has ever existed, there have always been the poor. No matter what government or society we humans have created, inevitably there ends up being those who have more than others. Those who are rich, those who are poor. Whenever we structure ourselves as humans, we end up with a blocked economy, at least to some. And as Jesus says, we will always have the poor. So how do you deal with that? How do you pirate that blocked economy? Sorry, I'll mute myself next time. The municipal laws we find in this book are just incredibly fascinating. And so when these people entered the promised land after a long, long time wandering in the wilderness, every family is given a parcel of land. And these are the laws that sort of surround that. When you reap the harvest of your land, do not reap to the very edges of your field or gather the gleanings of your harvest. Do not go over your vineyard a second time or pick up the grapes that have fallen. Leave them for the poor and the foreigner. I am the Lord your God. Again in Leviticus 23. When you reap the harvest of your land, do not reap to the very edges of your field or gather the gleanings of your harvest. Leave them for the poor and for the foreigner residing among you. I am the Lord your God. That didn't work at all. In Leviticus 25, if any of your fellow Israelites become poor and are unable to support themselves among you, help them as you would a foreigner and a stranger. And we have to remember when we read that, remember back when we explored Genesis, how do people treat foreigners and strangers? Abraham, Lot, they're willing to give up everything for a stranger. So this is a high code of conduct. Treat them as you would a foreigner or stranger, so they can continue to live among you. Do not take any interest or any profit from them, but fear your God, so they may continue to live among you. You must not lend them money at interest or sell them food at a profit. I am the Lord your God, who brought you out of Egypt to give you the land of Canaan and to be your God. Later on, if any of your fellow Israelites become poor and sell themselves to you, do not make them work as slaves. They're to be treated as hired workers, temporary residents among you, and they are to work for you until the year of Jubilee. Once every 7 years, everybody has all their debts forgiven, everybody's freed, everybody's sort of, the thing is reset. They and their children are to be released. They go back to their own clans, to the property of their ancestors, because the Israelites are my servants, whom I brought out of Egypt. So they must not be sold as slaves. Do not rule over them ruthlessly, but fear your God. Leviticus has very strong ethics around how a nation or group of people should address poverty in our midst. And I think there's two things worth noting here. First is this. In Leviticus, the ethic seems to be this. Remember Egypt. You were rescued from poverty. What's interesting to me here is regarding these laws is the law sort of cements for them this history into their memory. God reminds them, hey, you know, when you're considering how to treat the poor, remember, you were poor and you were enslaved and I rescued you. And I think this is kind of the heartbeat of the ethic. The only difference between you and the person in poverty is circumstance. Perhaps a measure of luck, measure of grace. Remember, you were in Egypt as slaves. And don't fool yourself into thinking that your lot in life is based entirely on your hard work. Life is mysterious. There's elements that we don't understand. Remember, through no fault of your own, Israel, you became enslaved. You found yourself in poverty. Don't forget that life can work sometimes like that. I delivered you from poverty. You know, I think that's telling for us. We need to always remember life is more complex than a simple formula of those who work hard get ahead. And when thinking about the poor, remember the distance between them and us is much smaller than we often think. So that's the heart of the ethic here. There's a second, though. The ethic described in these passages comes down to a line that is repeated for effect. The goal is to ensure that the poor may continue to live among them. I think this is a huge deal. And then they're told specific ways how to do that. So the poor must have access to free food. They're to be treated with care and dignity and given shelter according to hospitality codes and laws. They are to enable the poor to continue to live among them, not on the streets, not in shelters. Their standard of living housing should allow them to remain part of the community. And so they cannot be charged interest on loans. If they buy food, it must be sold at cost. They're released from debt after 7 years. I think the ethic is this. The poor deserve to have their basic needs, food and housing, met. Everyone in the community deserves a basic standard of living. In fact, I would say this. This is perhaps human history's earliest form of basic income legislation. Now, what might that mean for us? Well, I want to address this in sort of two parts, two ways. First, I want to address what does this look like for us on a cultural level that we're a part of? And then I want to address it at a micro level. What does this mean for Nexus here? How can we be generous with the poor? Well, let's start culturally. I think I would say this. I think we all know this. Culturally, we're very, very divided over what it means to care for the poor. On one side, there are those who think we have a cultural duty, a moral responsibility to fund and care for the poor in some capacity through taxes. We fund programs that ensure we try to help eradicate poverty. And then there are others who would think that care for the poor should be done entirely through individual acts of charity. It's unfair of the government to take a share of my income through tax and use that to subsidize anti-poverty programs. Of course, there's plenty of people somewhere in between. So there's that. And then there's, of course, how we view poverty. Again, on the one hand, there are those who think poverty is entirely sort of, I don't know, how would you say, out of the agency of the individual. Those in poverty are pure victims. And then on the other hand, of course, there are some who would say, well, individuals who are poor often make irresponsible decisions. And then there's a bunch of people in between. So how do we think about poverty on a cultural level? Well, I want to start with Rutger Bregman. He's the author of a fascinating little book called Utopia for Realists. And what I appreciate about Bregman is he's bold enough to start with a question that I don't think many of us would ask in polite company. His question is this: why do the poor make so many poor decisions? He grants, this is a harsh question, but he says, the data is hard to ignore. Study after study shows the poor, they borrow more, save less, smoke more, exercise less, drink more, eat less healthily, on and it goes. The poor, he says, do make poor decisions. And because of that, our attitudes around them tend to move from lack of empathy to sort of this paternalistic lecturing. So let's start there. The poor make poor decisions. What do you do with that? By helping them, are we simply enabling them? First time Chris and I moved into a house, we bought a townhouse way down on Upper Mercer Street, right by the Breslau Airport. And this was, what are we talking, 12 years ago, something like that? I don't know. But we were the very first people to move into our townhouse. It was the end of the development. There was nobody else around for a long, long time. And so we really enjoyed it. It felt like a country home at the time. And it was during the summer, and Kristen had gone up to the cottage to enjoy some time there. I was home alone, and I had a wonderful day. And I went to bed that night, and I was sort of drifting off. And all of a sudden, I heard this car go, and then, and then this horn. And I jumped out of bed and looked out the window, and I could just see lights and smoke. And I won't go into too many details, but I would say this. I sleep with very few things covering me, and that made what I had to do next difficult. I knew I had to get outside quickly. And so I was trying to put my track pants on, and I remember I tripped, and I'm trying to get my clothes on to get outside. And finally, I get outside, and I run down because our house was on a bit of an embankment. And so I ran down the embankment. There's a car on its roof, and the horn is just, and I'm terrified. What am I going to find in this car? And so I slowly go up to the window. Hello, is there anyone in there? And then I get up to close to the car, and its window goes up because it was upside down. And immediately I'm hit with just alcohol. I'm like, dude, are you okay? And I still remember what he said. He said, yeah, I'm fine. Don't call the cops. Can you push my car over back on its wheels? And I said, I don't think I can do that alone. He said, seriously, don't call the cops. Now, this guy was drunk as a skunk. And so I have a question before me. He made a poor choice. What a poor choice for someone to make. Perhaps in that moment I should have said, you've made some poor choices this evening, sir. I'm going back to bed. No. What kind of jerk would you have to be to turn away from someone, even though they've made a poor decision? What kind of jerk would you have to be to walk away from that situation? And so I called the cops, and he eventually wiggled his way out of the car, and I could see he's pushing, trying to get it over. He's collecting his front bumper, you know, kind of. I'm like, dude, you got to settle down. And it was interesting when the cops showed up. They said he's actually lucky. He was drunk, he was so loosey-goosey, he didn't hurt himself. But it's like, just because someone makes a poor decision doesn't mean you don't help. And what I appreciate about Bregman is he starts there. Okay, let's look at the data. Yes, poor people often make poor decisions, but he wanted to push further. In his research, he concluded, okay, why? Why do the poor make poor decisions? Is there something wrong with them? And he ended up spending years doing studies on this. His inquiry eventually led him to a study done by Stanford psychology professors. They had traveled to India to do a fascinating study on the IQ of sugarcane farmers there. And what's interesting about sugarcane farmers is that they make 60% of their income in basically a two-week span at harvest time. And so they get most of their pay in two-week periods, which means that for a small part of the year, they live relatively wealthy, and then the rest of the year they live relatively in poverty. And so they did a series of IQ tests, and what they found is that these farmers, their IQ tests, when they took them before the harvest, it was much worse than when they took these IQ tests after the harvest. And what their conclusion was is this: the effects of living in poverty correspond to losing 14 points of IQ. Which I suppose sounds like a rather arbitrary number, but losing 14 points of IQ is the same as going without a sleep for a whole night or living under the effects of alcoholism. It's equivalent to trying to make decisions when you haven't slept the night before. This poverty effect on IQ is a phenomenon Eldar Shafir, author and professor of this study, calls scarcity mentality, which is the odd ways we behave when we think things are scarce. There's a theological term for this as well. We call it living in a spirit of poverty. This is what George Orwell was referring to when he said the essence of poverty annihilates the future. Living in poverty has a way of eradicating any long-term decision-making, any long-term perspective. And so what Rutger Bregman concluded was this: the poor are not making dumb decisions because they're dumb, but because they're living in a context in which anyone would make dumb decisions. And I know this from personal experience, but I want to be careful here. I should check my notes on this. I don't want to pretend I have ever lived in poverty. But there was a season of life for Chris and I where we had no money. And two of the stupidest financial decisions I ever made were during that time. I was working at another church, Grandview, at the time. Kristen was in school, and I was interning at this church, and they were paying me $200 a month. That's what we were bringing in, $200 a month. And we were maxed out in school debt, and so we were living basically on credit card, amassing debt. And every year, the staff at this church, they did like a charity project. They would collect money as a staff, and they would give it to some sort of charity. And I remember sitting at a staff meeting as the intern, and that year, I was the charity project, which is a very weird feeling, to have people sitting around and then go, "Hey, we know you're really broke, so your charity project this year." And so right before Christmas time, they gave me an envelope with $500 cash in it. And I remember I got home, I'm like, "Kristen, wow, he gave us $500 cash right before Christmas. This is great." And so I don't want to put any blame on Kristen for this. This was mostly my idea. I'm like, "I got a great idea. Let's go shopping at Yorkdale Mall for Christmas presents for others, but let's make a night out of it. Let's get a hotel." So we did, by Yorkdale. There was $150. And then we got to the hotel. We were going to go shopping the next day for Christmas presents. I said, "Hey, I know you always wanted to see Mamma Mia. We should go see Mamma Mia tonight. I got some cash." So we went and we saw Mamma Mia. There was another $150. Then we ate out, probably another $100 between that. I would say $400 of the $500 I was given, we just blew on ourselves. A stupid decision. But what happens is, in a scarcity mentality, you can't see the future. "You know, this would be very wise for me to start paying back some of the people I owe right now." No, it's like, "I have a lot right now. I can do something with that." Or just a few months later, a similar thing happened. We had so little money, we had borrowed $2,000 from Kristen's parents. I never recommend borrowing money from your in-laws. It's just, you know, an awkward thing. So we got our tax return, and lo and behold, I got $2,000 from the government back. And I said to Kristen, "We should go to Cuba. That'd be great. We got $2,000. And she said, "Yes." And then I remember we went to Kristen's parents, and we said, "Hey, we got $2,000. We're going to Cuba. Can you take care of our cat?" And they were so incredibly good. They didn't say anything like, "Hey, you might want to pay me back first." But I still just remember that look like, "Huh. Okay, it was a stupid decision. A smart decision would have been, now we need to start paying things back. We've got some money in the pocket. Let's start getting ourselves out of debt." But when you live in a scarcity mentality, that's hard to do. It's hard to see beyond the future. And you see, this is why Bregman, he believes so many anti-poverty programs, they don't work. And he cites analysis. There's a study done on over 200 studies on how effective money management training is for the poor, and found that it's essentially not effective at all. And why? He says it's like teaching someone to swim and then throwing them into a stormy sea. Because in the way we think about poverty, according to Bregman and others, it addresses the symptoms, not the cause. And so the solution, according to Bregman and others, is simple. Universal basic income. And I don't want to get too far down this road, but I think this is something the church needs to wrestle with and have a voice in the discussion about. Say, what's a universal basic income? This is how Rutger describes it. It's a monthly grant, enough to pay for your basic needs, food, shelter, education. It's completely unconditional, so no one's going to tell you what you have to do for it, and no one's going to tell you what you have to do with it. A basic income is not a favor, but a right. There's absolutely no stigma attached. Before we jump to the conclusion that this idea must be coming from a certain brand of politics, this is an idea that has both skeptics and champions on both the left and the right. Martin Luther King Jr. was a big advocate for it, but so was Milton Friedman. He was one of the most prominent thinkers and advocates for free markets. In fact, the conservative political scientist Charles Murray, fan of the idea, he says this: an income stream gives people moral agency whether they want it or not. Even Margaret Wente, a conservative commentator from the Globe and Mail, says this: far from promoting government dependency, a universal basic income is the best way to check the growth of entitlement spending, to promote individual initiative, self-sufficiency, and human thriving. If you want to end poverty, just give people money. Now, you might be thinking, has this been tested? Could we afford it? Those are all questions I'd love to explore with you. And we actually happen to have in our midst the communication director of Basic Income Ontario, Josh Hissa. And so at a future time, probably in the new year, we're going to arrange like a pop-up pub theology where we can talk about basic income, because I think it's an idea worth exploring. It's an idea I think that we should be knowledgeable of, and I think we should be able to think about it, speak about it. So that's coming. But back to Leviticus. What we see in Leviticus are two clear ethics around poverty. The first is, remember, you're not so far yourself from poverty. I rescued you. You didn't pull yourself up by your bootstraps. I rescued you. And second is this: ensure the poor can continue to live among you. Now, in no way do I believe we should structure our laws around Leviticus, because there's some weird stuff there. But I do think there's something instructional here. I do think these ethics matter, especially if we want to be communally generous. But what about Nexus specifically? What could this community here do to be more generous, to play a part in caring for the poor? What could we do that would take us beyond the symptoms of poverty? Well, I want to, for a moment, dream a little with you. And then I want to put the brakes on and make things very awkward for you. So that should be fun. But let's dream a little here. One of the things we continually hear about these days is affordable housing. And for a lot of people, the housing market is such that a lot of people have been priced right out of the housing market. Rent costs are astronomical for people. When Kristen and I consider if we were just trying to get into the housing market today, it would be virtually impossible for us. And I think that's a case for a lot of people. Rent has become astronomical. And so one of the ideas playing around in my mind is, could Nexus in some way address affordable housing? Because over the past year or so, we did the Nexus Listening Project, you will remember, and I frequently talk with many of you, and what has become very clear to me is that Nexus has in its midst both the passion and the expertise to consider something like this. We have the people in our midst that could allow us to potentially look into us as a community playing a role in affordable housing. And I think that could be an exciting idea for us to get behind. And so what I want to do this morning is ask us to give ourselves permission to dream about what a community this size could do to help the poor, because I haven't even gotten to the New Testament. We know what the New Testament and Jesus have to say about the poor and what church communities do about that. This is just speaking out of Leviticus. But it seems clear to me that any community that calls itself Christian needs to be involved meaningfully in some way with poverty issues. And I think that's one way we could potentially, as just an idea, work at that. But I want to put the pause button on, because before we can dream and even think about bigger ideas that God might be calling us to, I think we need to look at our current status here and do some in-house work. And I'm just going to say, if you are visiting Nexus today or are relatively new here, I apologize for what's coming. Because rarely at Nexus do we talk about money, to the point that it's almost a fault of ours. And the reason for that is we don't want anyone to feel guilted into giving here. We really don't. I believe Jesus' generosity, giving ethic, is that giving should be done with joy. That trumps all other things. If we can't give with joy, then there's a problem. And so we've never, ever wanted anyone here to feel guilted into giving. But the reality is this. Nexus right now is $25,000 behind on our 2008 budget, 18 budget. And it's November, our end of year is end of December. And for a church our size, that's not insignificant. And here's the thing. I think Nexus is at a crossroads in our history. We have some decisions to make about who we are, what kind of community we want to be. Are we content? And I think there's a case for this. Are we content to just kind of, this is what we do. We do what we do, and this is kind of it. Or are we ready and perhaps willing to dream bigger than this? I think there's a question, and I believe God wants us to dream bigger, but I think the reality is we can't begin to do that unless we're covering our own costs here. And this stuff is tricky to talk about. If you're uncomfortable right now, I'm even more so. This is awkward. So let me be straight up honest about the Nexus budget, which we don't often talk about either. When you give to Nexus, where does it go? What does it go to? Well, this guy. My salary is a big part of the Nexus budget, and I think it's a generous salary that Nexus and the leadership team give me. I'll add a caveat. I don't get benefits. I don't get a pension. I don't have disability insurance, but it's a very generous salary. And I want to add that it's a generous enough salary that I hope it allows me to be generous as well. Because one of the things that I've noticed about other pastors who have churches about this size, a lot of them are my friends, and I hope they're not listening, but they are stingy. And I know way too many pastors who every time they have a Tim Hortons coffee, church, here's the receipt, I want my $1.25 back for that. And what I have so appreciated about Nexus is I don't have to do that. And I certainly have a lot of work to do in becoming more generous, but I appreciate at the very least, I don't feel like I need to be stingy. Beyond that, Dave and Kasha over in Kids, they make a very meager quarter of a salary. We also have childcare workers who make an hourly rate for Sunday mornings, and that's only because we never have enough volunteers to serve our kids. Beyond that, we pay for rent here, and we get this place cheap. Don't tell the Conrad Center. But I know a lot of other churches pay about double what we pay here. We cover website, podcast, hosting costs. We have a small fund that covers some of our Sunday morning expenses, like some of the things you saw last week, some of that art stuff. We have a benevolent fund at Nexus, which we use to give small monetary gifts to those in need at Nexus, and it is completely maxed out right now. And then we have a fund for the food table, which Jen Lambert told you about 2 weeks ago, a food table where some of our community parents go out and give food to anyone who wants it. Could be marginalized, could be homeless, could be just anyone who wants it downtown. Few miscellaneous costs, and that's it. So I think we run a tight ship here. And I also want to make it explicitly clear, because I think sometimes people are confused about this. We have a number of volunteers here who spend, if not 40 hours a week, at least close to that, doing Nexus stuff. Julie Cairns, Murray Baker, chief among those, spend a lot of time and do not get paid. There are many others who give at least part-time hours to Nexus. And so what I don't think is this. I don't think Nexus could ever be accused of spending extravagantly or excessively. I really don't. But before we can dream, We have a fork in the road decision in front of us as a community. We're $25,000 behind, and that's just to cover the basics. Before we can afford to dream, we have to be able to afford this. And that's on all of us if you call Nexus home. And listen, I get so, I know how tough it is to give, because giving to a church is not sexy at all. It really isn't, compared to many other sexy causes out there. And you know, that's on us, that's on Kristen and I as well, and I get how life is tough. Like, you ever had one of those weeks? We did this week where Kristen was driving to work and our Corolla just died, right? Just died. And you're sitting there going, oh, Jesus, this is going to be 500, 1,000, like, what is this? What are we looking at? And I know how life is. It's difficult. It's difficult to give. But I believe God wants communities and churches that are generous. I believe God wants this community to be generous. I also believe that this community itself actually wants to be generous. And we've done it before in the past. When there was a vision to support a refugee family, we rose to the challenge with ease. And so if we get to a place where we could afford to dream, I think there's place for vision and dreaming here. Here's some things that people have talked to me about Nexus, through the Nexus Listening Project, others who have pitched visions to me. There's some internal stuff to do. We could probably use some administrative help at Nexus. We need to be thinking about youth in the future. We've got a lot of young kids coming up there. We've already got some youth. But beyond that, I think affordable housing is really something that could play to our unique strengths here at Nexus. And I haven't passed this by the leadership team. I'm throwing stuff at the wall here. But I really believe Nexus could buy a building, but a building that's not for us. And I think it's time that churches start reckoning with where they spend their money. And perhaps we could spend money on affordable housing. I think that's an option. It's just one idea. I'm just throwing it out there. But I think if we're going to start dreaming bigger, we need to give ourselves permissions to do so. I'm going to ask the band to come and close us with a song. But the truth is this. We're behind. This is awkward. I know. But I just want to leave you with this question. If you are able, and I realize not everyone is able, if you're in a position to do so, if you find the work of Nexus meaningful, if you believe in what Nexus is about, if you believe a community like ours needs to start dreaming, then I would ask you to consider giving to Nexus. There's pre-authorized forms at the table and other ways to give. You can find out about that at the info table up there. I'm really wishing I had something else to close on, because that's a little awkward. But I hope I don't have to talk about this again for another little while. But why don't we leave it there? Next week, we're going to talk about more about personal generosity and a weird passage from Paul where he says the lazy shouldn't work. So we're going to look at that, and that will be interesting. So I'm going to leave it with band. Go in peace this morning, and I hope you enjoy this final song about dreaming a little.